106.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's a simple idea at the core of Marion Nestle's landmark book, Food Politics. At a time when public health workers and nutritionists say we should be cutting back on calories, we aren't. In part because many food producers are working hard to keep us eating and drinking what they make and sell. Nestle writes in great detail about the lengths to which food makers go to promote their products, from mass media advertising and marketing campaigns to lobbying lawmakers, government agencies, and even nutritionists and researchers. The net result, Nestle says, is a country where obesity and diabetes are growing public health problems. Finding solutions to the issues she raises in the book isn't at all simple. Even those who agree that there are too many empty calories in our diets and not enough healthy ones don't agree over what to do about it. But Marion Nestle says there are signs of progress, a growing grassroots movement to raise awareness of food issues that's helping more and more Americans better understand not only what's on their plates, but how it got there. Today on The Exchange, author Marion Nestle, 10 years after her groundbreaking book, Food Politics. And let's hear from you. Do you think the food industry has become more transparent, or has it gotten less so? Whose responsibility is it for Americans to eat healthy? Is it the government, the food industry, or does the consumer need to get more educated? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. Our guest for the hour is Dr. Marion Nestle. She's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, and a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. She's the author of several books, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition. And Marion Nestle, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
Food seems now to occupy a place in our culture that perhaps it did not a decade ago when Food Politics came out, and certainly not when I was growing up and learning about food.
Well, we're in the middle of what looks to me like an enormous social movement based around food, where so many people, particularly young people, care about where their food comes from, how it's produced, the conditions under which the workers who produce the food are living, and really care about what they're putting in their bodies, not only for their own health, but for the health of the planet. And I think that's enormously exciting. It's been, for me, it's just been enormous fun to watch.
The Village Voice said that some of the new food vanguarders is in it for those issues that you mentioned, the sustainability, the health, the interest in bringing more food into the local economy. And yet others may be in it more for style, to have eaten at the right restaurant, or, to post the best picture of their dish on a food blog. Is there room to coexist for all of those people under this new movement?
Well, there seems to be, whether we like it or not, there seems to be. I mean, I think it's hilarious to go to restaurants and everybody in the restaurant has their cell phone out taking pictures of what they're eating. I think it's quite funny. But I'm much more interested in the more socially conscious aspects of that. Those are people who are doing it for style and for the beauty of what's on the plate or for the deliciousness or whatever, and all of that is part of food. It's always been there. But it seems to me that what's new is this tremendous interest in the everything about food, from agriculture to public health, the entire spectrum, and the increasing understanding that agriculture is connected to public health, and that if we're going to have a reasonable agricultural policy in the United States, it has to be very tightly linked to health policy.
You write that when the book Food Politics first came out, you hoped, and I'll just quote, that, quote, it would encourage people to stop thinking about food companies as social service agencies, that instead we should understand these are economic actors who look to make a profit. Has that changed at all in the 10 years since this book came out?
Oh, I think there's increasing recognition of that. And the place where you see that most prominently is in discussions of childhood obesity. I'm just back from a childhood obesity conference in California that was just extraordinary to me to see, because the entire discussion was focused on what do we do to get the food industry to stop marketing to children. And that is such a change. I mean, well, that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book, Food Politics, was because I was tired of going to conferences about childhood obesity where the only thing that was discussed was how do we get parents to feed their kids better. The entire focus 10 or 15 years ago was on parental responsibility for what their kids eat. And that has totally changed. I mean, we're still concerned about educating parents, don't get me wrong, and I'm really in favor of education of everybody around food issues. But the idea that education comes up against a food system in which marketing is intense and unrelenting is something that I think has been interesting for people to observe and to understand.
And let's delve into that a little bit more, because the one side of that we all see and encounter is the advertising. We see it on TV and magazines and on radio and so forth. And you write about this in Food Politics. How else does that effort to get consumers to eat more play out that may not be as visible but is just as important or just as essential?
Oh, you see it in the lobbying of food companies in Congress, in the invisible marketing that nobody even notices, which is everything from electronics to T-shirts, the idea of making the brand names of different food products absolutely ubiquitous. So there's so much a part of the landscape that nobody even thinks of them as marketing. The sponsorship of sports and music figures, the kinds of materials that are given to students in schools. I mean, all of these things are, or the one that I'm particularly interested in these days because of some research that I'm doing is the philanthropy. The food companies' donations of funds to, let's say, anti-hunger organizations, in order to get those organizations to take political positions that will, I guess the most obvious example is SNAP, the food stamp program. Anti-hunger organizations have a very strong position that people who receive food stamps should be able to spend their stamps on any food they want, whether it's a junk food or a soda or anything else, and that they shouldn't have any limitations on their choice. And those organizations are heavily funded by food companies that benefit from that political position.
And you write also that the marketing continues into your own field, that nutritionists get marketing materials. They're sent even to you.
Oh, well, the food companies sponsor our conferences and sponsor our journals and, in some cases, sponsor research. And that's been an increasing source of concern as people have come to recognize that this is no different than drug industry marketing or, if you can remember it, cigarette industry marketing.
And one of the net effects of this is a phrase that you point to. It's called paradox of plenty. Could you explain a little bit about what exactly that means?
Well, that's a term that was coined by Harvey Levinstein, who's a food historian in Canada. And what he meant by that was that we have, you know, this enormous amount of food around, but the advice is to eat less of it. And that's that a complicated concept for a lot of people.
And at the same time, I mean, with all of that food out there, there's that term, and I'm sure you've heard it, food deserts, the areas of the country that don't have the access to fresh, healthy food. And I'm curious if that's a byproduct of this system.
Well, I don't know whether that's a byproduct or not. I would say the point where it connects is that for grocery stores, for example, they feel that they're not going to get the same kind of profits out of poor neighborhoods as they are for wealthier neighborhoods. And so they don't want to put stores into those places because they're not going to work as well. But, of course, what that does is it means that there isn't the same opportunity to buy good, healthy food in poor areas as there are in wealthy areas. And if you want to talk about another paradox of plenty, plenty. Food in low-income areas tends to cost more than it does in higher-income areas in some cases, and especially in the fresh foods. And there's research that's now showing that. We need to do some things to make it easier for poor people to eat healthfully, and lots of people are working on those kinds of ideas and trying to figure out ways to do that.
Today on The Exchange, Food Politics. 10 years ago, Marion Nestle's groundbreaking book on how the American food industry influences nutrition and health was met with praise and criticism. Nestle has expanded and revised her influential book, raising questions about the roles of personal and corporate responsibility and finding that the food industry in many ways is still encouraging unhealthy behavior in order to make profits. We invite you to join us as well. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a comment or question through our Facebook page. You write, Marion, that one of the ways that the food producers try to get their point across and advance their interests is to water down or just make it very difficult for people to find information about their food and about food research in general. And I noticed on your blog that oftentimes readers come to you and say, you know, I've tried to look up about salt in diet and I've tried to look at the research. I'm throwing my hands up. I can't understand what that is. And what goes into that? Why is it so difficult to understand something about the salt we eat?
Well, the research is difficult, and I think enormously intellectually challenging to try to figure out what people eat and the effects of what they eat on their health. And the reason it's so complicated is that people differ. They differ in genetics, in behavior, in lifestyle characteristics, in everything else they eat. It's very, very difficult to single out the effects of one dietary component like salt from the effects of everything else that people are eating. For example, most salt in the diet comes from processed foods or restaurant foods.
And we're just going to take a quick break here, and we'll pick right back up with that about the processed food. We invite you to join us as well on The Exchange, the number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And starting next week, you can get twice as much here and now on NHPR. The new two-hour version begins at noon with its signature mix of hard news and rich conversation. And word-of-mouth fans can tune in at 2 p.m. to discover emerging trends throughout our culture with NHPR's Virginia Prescott. Our new lineup starts next Monday at noon. More on food politics on The Exchange, then a 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, legal and diplomatic twist in the NSA leaker case. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Spine Center at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, using research results to build customized treatment plans. Information at dhspine.org. And from the New Hampshire Humanities Council, proudly presenting more than 60 family-friendly humanities programs throughout the state in July. More information at nhhc.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing food politics and the American food industry. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment or a question on our Facebook page. Our guest today, Marion Nestle. She's the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, and a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. She's authored several books, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition, which is now in its 10th anniversary edition. You can find a link to Marion Nestle's blog at our website on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Just before the break, Marion, we were talking about the role that salt plays in processed food, and I wanted to give you a chance to finish up that thought.
To finish my sentence here. If the main sources of salt in the diet are processed foods and restaurant foods, then you have to ask, what else is everybody eating along with that salt? or to put it bluntly, the main sources of salt are junk foods because salt makes them taste better. So if that's what people are eating, maybe it's something else in the food. Maybe it's the totality of the diet that influences people's health. And it's very, very difficult to single out a single component of the diet and attribute particular problems to it. So that's why I think the research on salt is sometimes appears to be so conflicting, and people interpret it in different ways. When you have research that's complicated to interpret, the interpretation depends on the viewpoint of the interpreter. And that allows a lot of conscious and unconscious biases to come into the interpretation. So it seems like a mess, but in fact there are things that we know that have been shown over and over and over again, and that is that it's healthier to eat fruits and vegetables and not gain too much weight.
And yet those are often left to the people who seek them out, whereas people who are, say, in the grocery store are probably oftentimes relying on what they see on the package. I think we see that there are nutrition facts on there. We see a list of ingredients, and we think, okay, well, I know what I need now. And yet you write that there are a lot of potentially misleading items on a food product label. The term natural is one that comes to mind. What might that mean on a label, something like natural or farm fresh?
Oh, if only I knew. The FDA doesn't have the FDA doesn't have a regulatory definition for natural. So, anything that is that isn't any food that doesn't have anything artificial added to it can be said to be natural. And of course, the FDA has ruled that high fructose corn syrup is natural. So I don't know what you do with that. I mean, it's hard to get your head around that. I wish that the FDA would come up with a regulatory definition. It would make everybody's job much easier, particularly because there's now a considerable amount of research that shows that people can't tell the difference between natural and organic on food labels, and they have very, very different meanings.
And organic does have a fairly strict set of conditions.
Yeah, it has a regulatory definition, and when you get something that's organic, if you know what that definition is, you know exactly what you're getting. With natural, you do not.
We got an email a moment ago from Liz in Londonderry who says, I heard not too long ago that the food lobby, she says corn and wheat in particular, are responsible for the bottom of the food pyramid, that nutritionists wanted grains to have a smaller spot on the pyramid. Any truth to this that you know of?
Well, we haven't had a food pyramid now for, since 2005. We now have a plate, and the plate says make half your plate fruits and vegetables. But the pyramid that I think she's talking about is the one that came out in 1992, and that followed a series of major reports that said that the main problem with the American diet was that it had too much fat in it, and that people would be a lot healthier if they ate more carbohydrates, meaning whole grains, although nobody really realized that. And that idea came about because fat has twice the calories of carbohydrate, and nobody really thought at the time that if they said eat less fat, the food industry would make food products that didn't have much fat in them but had lots and lots of sugars, and that people would quickly make up for the caloric deficit by eating a lot of high-carbohydrate, high-sugary foods. And that didn't turn out very well. And there are some people who think that that was actually responsible for the rise in levels of obesity, but I think it's just calories in general. If people eat too many calories, they're going to put on weight.
But as you point out, I mean, we don't actually have a food pyramid anymore. This idea of the government providing a set of guidelines for consumers to use as they map out their diets has changed drastically over the last few decades. And a lot of what is proposed to be in there winds up changing before the final draft comes out. And you write a lot of that is because there is this government effort to provide the dietary guidelines, and food companies want to make sure that their interests are part of that program and part of that discussion, too.
Yeah, and the amount of lobbying that food companies do about any issue having to do with food is really amazing. I mean, you can go and look at the lobbying reports that they have to file with the government, that lobbyists have to file, and they give a list of the issues that they're lobbying about. They don't say necessarily which side of the issue they're on, but they say what they're lobbying about. And they're lobbying about every single issue that you can possibly think of that might affect their bottom line. If some kind of law came out on it. So they're lobbying about the farm bill. They're lobbying about the issues in Mrs. Obama's Let's Move campaign. They're lobbying about transportation law. They're lobbying about fuel costs. They're lobbying about absolutely everything that you can, every issue you can think of, no matter how small it may seem to be. And they certainly were lobbying about federal dietary guidelines and the pyramid or the food guide. The new dietary guidelines committee for 2015 has just been appointed. I don't know, 5 years is the Congress had said in 1990 that the government had to do new dietary guidelines every 5 years. 5 years is seeming sooner and sooner to me. I think they really ought to change that. It's ridiculous to have new guidelines every 5 years. The research doesn't change that much within a five-year period. The research moves very slowly and incrementally, and any committee that is tasked with the job of developing new guidelines is going to want to change them from the previous one just because they're spending a lot of time on a committee, and otherwise they'd be wasting their time.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. Steve is calling in from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning, Brady. This is Steve Sorf from Nottingham. As I told you, is that when you did the forum show that I had a direct line, and I'm using it right now.
Hi there.
What I want to talk about is what is actually happening right in the food industry, probably because of regulations, is I want to trumpet the idea of labeling. I am kosher, and so I've always looked at labels all my life to find out what is in it to make sure I can eat it. But my son is on a gluten-free diet, and to know what's in it is very important. So that's all I want to do is trumpet the fact that if people could simply read the labels, first of all, you'd be astonished at how much salt and sugar is in so many items that we take for granted.
It's a great question, Steve. And Marion Nestle, I was in Washington, D.C. recently. I stopped by the ballpark there, and I was surprised at how much labeling there was on ballpark food now. There's vegan options at the ballpark. There's gluten-free food at the ballpark, and not to mention what goes on at the grocery store. What kind of impact does that have, then, for consumers?
Well, it means that the labels are absolutely important, or critically important. If you're somebody who's gluten intolerant, eating something with gluten in it is going to make you very sick, and for quite a while, and so you really want to avoid that. You don't want to eat anything that's had wheat in it, and so the labeling is critically important, and there's more and more pressure to clarify that and to make products that are gluten-free or are designed for people who have particular kinds of food needs. And I think that's terrific. That's one of the real functions that the label provides. But as the caller pointed out, if you're going to use the label, you've got to read it. It doesn't do any good if you're not reading it. For people who read labels, there's much information on them. For people who don't read labels, you know, it's catch as catch can.
Steve, thanks so much for the call. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Marion Nestle, I wanted to ask one more question about the food guide, formerly the food pyramid. How did the government get involved in offering dietary advice in the first place?
Well, it started, the Department of Agriculture started offering dietary advice to the public in, I think the first one was around 1915 or something like that. It was 100 years ago. And it's done so steadily and consistently ever since. It seems to me that's a completely reasonable government function to offer advice to the American people based on the most up-to-date research and the state of knowledge that we now have. It's in the government's interest to have a healthy population. I see that as a completely legitimate government function. Don't you?
Well, that's not for me to say, I suppose, but it certainly does seem to reflect what the government's priorities or what society's priorities have been through those different eras. When those food guides first started to come out, it seemed like the emphasis was on eating well to prevent disease, and now there's been the shift toward trying to get people to consider their foods more carefully and potentially eat less of them to avoid more obesity, to avoid diabetes and things like that.
Well, now that the American the American Medical Association has defined obesity as a disease, I would say it's still to prevent disease. I mean, there's been a big shift in the years prior to World War II and the years following that. The point about dietary advice was to help people prevent nutrient deficiencies and to promote eating a variety of food in order to do that, because there were lots of signs of specific vitamin and mineral deficiencies among people in the population because they were eating very limited diets that didn't include a lot of different kinds of foods. So when that shifted after World War II to diseases that are what we call chronic diseases, like obesity-related diseases such as type 2 diabetes or coronary heart disease and so forth, then the dietary advice had to change. And it became much more controversial because the previous advice was to eat more of a variety of American agricultural products. The current advice is to eat less of specific kinds of foods. And eating less advice is very, very bad for business. And food companies don't like it at all.
And you say that that's why that advice winds up oftentimes being couched. And in fact, when you were working on the Surgeon General's report, that you were given some pretty specific do's and don'ts about what to say and what not to say as part of that report. For example, you couldn't say, don't eat this or don't eat very much of this.
No, you had to do it in euphemisms. And one of the reasons why dietary advice is so confusing is that euphemisms refer to nutrients, not foods. People don't eat nutrients. They eat foods. So if you say, if the advice, let's say, was to eat less saturated fat, that's a code word for meat and dairy products that are the major sources of saturated fat. But you would never say eat less meat. You'd get into way too much trouble. And similarly, it's only very, very recently and buried hundreds of pages into documents that advice is to cut down on sugary sodas, even though that's an obvious place to start if you're going to try to lose weight. That's a really good place to start. So the advice, and even today, the advice is couched in euphemisms and not ever talking about specific products.
We got an email from Zoe, who wrote in from Portsmouth. She points to an article in Atlantic Magazine from David Friedman. It's called How Junk Food Can End Obesity. She says, according to the article, upper-class whole foodies, led by figures such as Michael Pollan, are hypocritical because some natural or organic foods are also high in fats and sugars. His answer to the obesity crisis in the U.S. is to turn to the fast food and processed food companies, counting on them to use FDA-approved chemical food additives to make healthier, low-fat, low-sugar, low-salt, but still processed foods. She says, taking into account that these are corporations whose only goal is to sell us more food to make more money, how do you see this suggestion playing out?
Yeah, I read the article, and it got my blood pressure up, as you might expect. I don't know anybody who's active in the food movement who doesn't care deeply about getting healthy food to low-income people who need it just as much as high-income people do. Everybody that I know is trying to figure out how to democratize the food movement and make sure that low-income people have access to healthy food at a price that they can afford. I thought that Friedman's article came across as an apology for the food industry. The food industry can't make really healthy products because they don't sell as well. And so you can say, well, this is an education question. How do we educate people to eat healthier products if they don't like the taste as much? Well, I don't know. If you're eating real foods, you don't have to worry about the kinds of things that are put into processed foods. The issue of processed foods is not that processed foods are poison. They're not. It's that people have a tendency to overeat them, or they're served in such... I mean, there's nothing wrong with an 8-ounce soda, which is the way sodas used to be produced. There's plenty that's wrong with a 32-ounce soda. So it becomes a matter of quantity rather than quality. So I thought, you know, he has a particular libertarian position in that article. It's worth reading. It's an interesting article, and it goes on and on and on and on. It's quite long. But I thought that a lot of it came from a particular political point of view that isn't one that I share.
Zoe, thanks so much for that email. And we invite you to send an email to us with your comments and questions for Marion Nestle, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also call us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about food politics. 10 years ago, Marion Nestle's groundbreaking book on how the American food industry influences nutrition and health was met with praise and criticism. Nestle has expanded and revised the influential book, raising questions about the roles of personal and corporate responsibility and finding that the food industry is still encouraging unhealthy behaviors in order to make profits. Again, we would like your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're about to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to take some more of your calls and emails, answering your questions and comments. And we're also going to talk about one of the questions that comes up in these debates over food and health. Where does the responsibility lie when it comes to Americans and their health and making healthy food choices? Is it the government? Is it food companies? Is it the individual? Is it any or all of the above? We'll talk about that and much more when we return. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine in Summersworth, where Dr. Moby Parsons now offers the direct anterior approach for hip replacement surgery. More at sosmed.org. And from Markham & Marge of Keene, New Hampshire, worldwide coating supplier, making their mark through people and innovation, locally and globally, for over 100 years. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Supreme Court rulings,
the Boston Marathon bombings,
presidential press conferences. The news does not stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Starting July 1st, you'll be able to hear the NPR news you rely on in the middle of your day.
And I am delighted to welcome Jeremy Hobson as my new co-host.
Here and Now.
Don't miss a thing.
Catch the new expanded Here and Now beginning next week at noon on NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we're looking at Lyme disease. Join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today, we're talking about food politics. Who is responsible for what America eats? You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And we're talking with Marion Nestle, the author of the book Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition. And Marion, that's the phrase that you often hear, personal responsibility, in these debates over food and health when it comes to food. Who's responsible for making sure that we're healthy. And we often hear the food industry and food producers saying, we make things that people want to buy, and we can't force it. We can't force people to eat things. They must make that decision themselves.
Well, both are involved, of course. But when people in the food industry make that statement that we just make foods, we're not holding up a gun and forcing people to eat, they're not talking about the extraordinary amounts of efforts that they go into marketing their products. And we know that marketing works. That's why they do it. Otherwise, they wouldn't. And so the way I like to talk about it is that in today's food environment, which is a food environment in which food is marketed not only through advertising but also through product placement, through availability, through price issues, through every conceivable way in which foods can be marketed, personal responsibility doesn't stand a chance. It's just impossible. If you're given a food portion that's too large for you to eat, almost everybody will eat more from a large food portion than they would from a small one. That's just human behavior, and food companies know it. So from the standpoint of obesity, the big issue is calories. You want to get people to eat less, not more, and you want everybody to be eating better, to be eating more healthfully. And that doesn't always go along with food industry interests. Obviously, if people are educated and can figure out ways of coping with the food system, they're going to be doing better, and that's terrific. But both are involved, and that's what makes it complicated.
You mentioned portion size, and here's an email from Jonathan that touches on that. He said, "We understand that portion size is a critical component of a healthy diet. As a high school science teacher, I am horrified by the lack of knowledge my students have concerning the size of packaging. When they learn that the jumbo bag of chips is cited as more than one serving, they show amazing disbelief. Additionally, student understanding of diet and calories lends itself to gimmicks. Is there a way we can inform students and the population in general of the laws of thermodynamics so that diet can be more wisely controlled?"
Oh, hi, John. Oh, that everyone was getting science instruction in schools so that they could understand the laws of thermodynamics, and that if you eat more calories than you put out in physical activity, you're going to put on weight. We don't have terrific science education in this country. We certainly need more of it, and that's part of why education is so important in all of this. On the other hand, the food companies would love for you to forget about the calories that are in foods. The whole business with the large size soda is a big issue in New York City because Mayor Bloomberg attempted to put a cap on soda sizes in the city at 16 ounces, and the industry went berserk, and everybody thought he was completely ridiculous for doing that. But people forget that larger portions have more calories. And if I had one concept that I could get across to everybody, it's that one. Larger portions have more calories. I can't even say it without laughing, but it in fact is not intuitively obvious, and people tend to think that if that all containers have 100 calories, no matter how big the containers are. We showed this with a student experiment where we asked students how many calories were in a 8-ounce soft drink and how many were in a 64-ounce soft drink, and the average multiplier was 3, not 8. And when we asked them, how could you multiply 64,
knowing that it's 8 sizes larger?
How could you get 3 out of that? They said, 800 calories in a soft drink is impossible. It's not possible for a soft drink to have 800 calories. But a 64-ounce soft drink does have 800 calories.
Now,
it really does.
The counterargument that I'm sure you've heard to that proposal in New York City was that people, aside from personal responsibilities, is that if people want to be able to drink a larger soda, they will still be able to do that. It's not going to stop them from, instead of getting a 64-ounce, to get, say, 2 32-ounces or 8 8-ounce sodas if they prefer. What do you make of that?
Or 4 16s. Yeah, they can do that. And the point about the 16-ounce soda cap was that people tend to eat what's in front of them. If they're given 16 ounces, they'll drink 16 ounces. If they're given 32 ounces, they'll drink 32. So if you give people smaller size foods, then they won't eat as much. Or they'll have to ask for it if they want more. It's called the default. If the default is smaller, then people will eat less. If the default is bigger, people will eat more. It's really that simple, and there's lots of behavioral research that's gone into that kind of thinking. And none of us likes to think that we're manipulated in that way. It really makes people uncomfortable to think that they don't have complete control over what they're eating. But if you look at the research, you find out that, I mean, I know for myself that if I'm given a lot of food and it's good food, I'll eat it. Yum. I really like to eat.
Let's take a call now from Jake, who's calling from Brownfield, Maine. Hi, Jake. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. How are you?
Very good.
Hey, I have no problem with our government controlling what goes into our food, whether it be poisons, whether it be pesticides or GMOs. But I do have a problem when our government starts taking over for personal responsibility. If the food is too big on your plate, don't eat it. If the food is not good for you, don't eat it. You vote with your pocketbook every time you make a purchase for what you believe in. I can't stand when people disregard personal responsibility when it comes to things like eating.
And in fact, Marion, one of the phrases that you use in your book is vote with your fork. And it sounds like Jake is saying you can vote with your fork to choose how much or what you'd like to eat rather than having someone else present and tell you how much should be in front of you.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. And that's why education is so important, to teach everybody what's good for them and, you know, and how to make those kinds of choices in a reasonable way. But what we're seeing in the research is that even the best intentioned people overeat when given large portions of food. This happens to be the easiest example to use, and that's why I'm repeating it. Even the best-intentioned people who say that they're not going to overeat will overeat when given large portions of food. So in some situations, in situations where there's heavy marketing, where food is served in large portions, personal responsibility doesn't work as well as you wish it would. So yes, you need to exercise personal responsibility, but we also need to have some responsibility of food companies for not making products that are going to make people unhealthy.
Jake, thanks so much for the call. Marion, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned the default, the idea that people will eat what's in front of them, at least when it comes to portion size. And I was curious whether that was true when it came to particular ingredients. I'm thinking of school lunch programs, which, you know, the typical school lunch you think of is, you know, the tater tot or the little pizza. And if a school were instead to, say, put greens in front of kids, do they start eating the greens then? Or is there more to it than that?
Well, there's lots to it than that. First of all, schools are the places where the food movement, I think, has had the greatest measurable effect. You can go into schools all over the country now and see kids eating really terrific food and being completely involved in the food and interested in it and eating their vegetables in places, in low-income areas where you would never think that this kind of healthy food would be available. So I chalk this up to an enormous effort, not only to get decent government rules so that schools could do this if they wanted to, but also lots of teachers, parents, and everybody else involved in trying to improve school food. It's really pretty terrific when you see it. And there's no question that when kids are offered the opportunity to grow food, to find out where food is comes from, and to explore different kinds of tastes, flavors, and textures, that they really go for it and are completely involved in it. It's really beautiful to watch. And it's happening everywhere. It's not just in elite schools. I've been to schools in some of the poorest areas of Brooklyn in New York, where the kids are being served lovely food and they're eating it very happily and lining up for the salads. It's kind of lovely to watch. So there's no question that this is working, and that's why so many people who are involved in the food movement are trying to teach kids about where food comes from, how where it grows, how it's produced, and what it tastes like. Yum.
That experience seems to run counter to a school of thought we've seen in books lately about sneaky foods, that if parents can hide spinach or broccoli in something that kids are used to eating, like pasta or a sandwich, then they'll get their nutritional value without feeling like, oh, I'm eating something yucky. And it sounds like you're saying that that's not necessarily the case.
I don't think that's necessary. I mean, there are situations in which kids are going to be very resistant to eating vegetables, for example. Again, there's a huge body of research on this by now that says that this is something that has to be presented many, many times, that it has to be part of what the family does. It has to be part of what the school does. And you have to create a culture and an environment that promotes healthy eating. But it's not that difficult to do. And that's been shown over and over and over again. And when I hear people talk about, well, we serve good food in schools, but the kids didn't eat it, I think there are adults in that school who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Because in schools in which food is being presented as part of the education and the training and the environment, the kids go for it. Not all of them, but a lot of them do.
I'm curious to know what you make of something that happened last year. It was a campaign, largely an online one, against what's known as pink slime, the meat product that became the high-profile target, lost a huge amount of business in the process. A lot of restaurants and chains decided we will not use pink slime because of this awareness campaign. Does that suggest a way forward for food advocates like yourself, that consumers can assert themselves in a certain way under certain circumstances?
Yes, this was a campaign begun by a mom, a school mom, Bettina Siegel, who discovered that this filler meat was being used in the meat that was being served in her school food, and started a petition on change.org to get rid of it. Pink slime is the crude name given to something that its official name is lean, finely textured beef. And it's the trimmings from meats that would ordinarily be thrown away because we don't eat them, ground up and treated in various ways in order to, you know, make it sterile. And the meat industry argues that it's a perfectly nutritious product. Other people would disagree and say that this is not something that we usually eat. That's why it was thrown away in the first place. It's the kind of thing that ordinarily you would expect to see in pet food, and they didn't want it fed to their kids. And it had a tremendous impact on the company that was making it. But a lot of people thought that the company that was making it should have been more transparent about what it was right from the beginning, and that it wouldn't have come as a shock to consumers if they had been more, if they had done more disclosure right up front. So the object lesson, I thought, from that incident was that companies have to be very transparent about what they're doing.
What about this spate of recent incidences where we've seen, say, cereal manufacturers who say, we're going to cut some of the sugar out of our products, we're going to add a few more whole wheat elements back in? Is that a sign of progress, would you say, or are you not so sure about that?
Well, it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. I mean, food manufacturers are caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, their best-selling products tend to be the junkiest. They're the ones with the most sugar, the most salt, the most additives. And when they start healthing them up, if the flavors, textures, colors change, then people aren't going to buy them. On the other hand, they're under tremendous pressure to contribute to solving the problem of childhood obesity instead of contributing to it. So they're trying to figure out what to do. and it's very difficult for them, and you have to have some sympathy for what they're going through, particularly when there's so much effort being placed on not eating processed foods or making processed foods a very small part of your diet rather than a very large part. So they're at the receiving end of a lot of negative messages and a lot of negative publicity, and they're trying to figure out what to do. The soda companies have responded by making bottled water. That's one way to do it, and selling a lot of bottled water and drinks that are designed to look as if they're healthier, whether they are or not, is another matter.
Last question for you as we wrap up for the hour. We have about 30 seconds left. Food Politics is now 10 years old. When it comes time to publish the 20th anniversary edition of the book, what do you think might be in there that isn't in the book today?
Well, I'm hoping it won't be necessary in 20 years. How's that for an answer?
you can make yourself obsolescent. Wow.
Yeah, you know, all you have to do to eat healthfully is eat more fruits and vegetables and not eat too much, and that really takes care of it. It's that simple.
Well, Marion Nestle, thanks so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Marion Nestle is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University and a visiting professor of nutritional sciences at Cornell. She's the author of several books, including Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition, which is now in its 10th anniversary edition. You can learn more about the book at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our interns are Faith Meixel and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the widening divide on Lyme disease. A series by Boston Globe reporter Beth Daly explores how the tick-borne illness continues to spread across the Northeast, all while doctors are increasingly divided on treatments, and as the public is often bitterly frustrated by the medical establishment's response and the lack of ready answers. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock here on NHPR, where we get...